WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latte from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Many of us have joined a local group with the aim of improving something in our neighborhood, making a positive change in our community, or somehow leaving the world a little better than we found it. But despite the best of intentions, many of our initiatives often fall short. Well, activist Linda Stout thinks she knows why, and she's come up with a roadmap of how to empower people from all backgrounds to build a collective vision and bring it to fruition. She's laid out that plan in her new book, Collective Visioning, How Groups Can Work Together for a Just and Sustainable Future. As a grassroots organizer for three decades, Stout's insights come from real work on the ground. Today, she is executive director of Spirit in Action. That's a nonprofit that seeks social change through cross-cultural efforts. And Linda Stout is here with me in the studio today. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Now, Linda, I want to start at the beginning because your upbringing is just fascinating and really is at the core of who you are and the work that you do. Tell us a little bit about your time in rural Appalachia and your parents and how they inform your work.
Well, I grew up the daughter of a tenant farmer who, when I was in high school, became a mill worker, but I started working in tobacco at the age of 10. And I grew up with the dream of going to college, although my parents never went past fifth grade. And I was the first to graduate in my family from high school, but I did not get to finish college, or even though I got a scholarship. But I also grew up 13th generation Quaker. And I think the combination of poverty and seeing the injustice both to my family and others, and the fact that I grew up knowing about resistance and fighting for change allowed me to do the work I do today.
But did you always feel like you would be a leader one day?
Never. Never. Or a writer.
So you didn't start with the confidence to be a leader.
I think many poor people, I grew up with in this society where you are taught to feel like it's your fault if you're poor, it's your fault if you aren't educated or you don't talk right, and that you don't have a understanding of the systemic problems that cause poverty and oppression and racism in the first place. And so we tend to turn on ourselves and blame ourselves instead of looking at the bigger system that causes these problems.
Now, you mentioned your Quaker upbringing. Tell a little bit more about how that led you to your grassroots organizing.
Well, I'm 13th generation Quaker, so I grew up with a lot of history of, you know, from Underground Railroad to, you know, seeing a secret passageway in my grandmother's house where people hid, you know, and knowing about that kind of standing up against injustice. And I think that really allowed me also the piece of Quakerism that's all about listening and following your heart. And I think of my practice as if I have a spiritual practice, it's listening, and it's not only listening internally but listening externally to what people want and what people need and how can we do this different. I say this book is a collective of many people's ideas and thoughts, not just mine.
And I want to get to some of your actual work on the ground in just a moment in the early years, and then your actual, what collective visioning is, your advice for all of us who want to do this kind of work. But I have to ask you one more question about the early years. You write that when you were younger, you would see other community organizers who seemed only to talk to college-educated people and unwittingly would use language that excluded you or your your peers. Say a little bit more about that and how you sought to overcome
that. Yeah, I was really interested in social justice and women's rights and peace issues and environmental issues that were happening in the early 70s. And I would go to those meetings, and all the materials were written for a college-educated level, and they expected people who came in, you know, you would get asked questions like, what's your degree in? And that would make you feel horrible. And
so there were assumptions made.
Yeah, there were assumptions made. And I still hear many groups say, well, you know, we invited those folks over there in that community, or we invited people of color, but they just didn't come, or they came and they never came back. And they had no clue why. So I actually wrote my first book, Bridging the Class Divide, about that, about what are, I call them invisible walls, because I used to think that these folks really didn't care, didn't really want us there. And then I realized, oh, yeah, they do care. And they really do want us there, but they're clueless about how to create a space that we can be a part of.
So in a way, you were given a gift because you had a way to see into this problem. Other people may have come from a different world, a different background and a different worldview, but you had this worldview.
Yeah, I think folks like me can be the translators.
The bridge.
The bridge.
All right. So now in the book, you talk about the nuclear weapons freeze campaign of the early 1980s. Many of our listeners will relate to this and will remember this. This was an extremely successful campaign at pressuring the government to limit nuclear weapons. In 1982, 1 million Americans turned out for a rally here in New York City against the nuclear arms race. And you later became a board member of that campaign. And you write about it as a powerful movement, but that eventually fell apart. What, in your view, happened?
I think, number one, it didn't include low-income people and people of color. And, you know, even when they had a big march after the first Iraq war, if you remember, it became two separate marches. And they weren't able to come together and make the links that needed to be connected.
The same bridge we were talking about.
Yes, the bridges. And so and they were focused on all that was wrong. And it was around fear. It was around, you know, people had nightmares because we were all talking about nuclear winter and what was going to happen if a nuclear bomb hit. And there was no vision of what the alternative was. And I believe that it's vision that keeps people in the work, even though it's really hard and really scary at times. But it's a vision of having something different and better that we can hold on to. And that's what's going to mobilize people. We also have to create an environment that all people can be a part of. And that includes our children and our families. And that's joyful, and that we have fun as well as doing the hard work.
So these are the two words in the book, collective visioning.
Right.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Here with me in the studio is Linda Stout. She is the author of the new book, Collective Visioning, How Groups Can Work Together for a Just and Sustainable Future. So, Linda, talk to us about collective visioning. What does the term really mean?
The term really means where, and I talk first in the book about how to find the folks in the community so that we can have all voices at the table, and how to create a environment and a cultural space that everyone feels welcome to and feels they have their power and their voice. And then we can do our collective visioning. And notice I don't call it a shared or common vision because I want everyone's vision to be a part of it. And then we can, from there, look at all the ideas that come from the whole group and say, okay, what do we want to prioritize and what can we do this year? And then create a plan of how to get there and revisit the vision constantly. In fact, I start telling one story in my book, Bridging the Class Divide, 14 years ago that I finished in this book because they just won a year ago. So I think it's really important that we are able to keep those visions alive for people.
And visioning, as you write about it, is a verb.
I do. I use it as a verb, even though that's not in the dictionary. I made it
it's
up.
It's in your dictionary.
It's in my dictionary.
And I want to touch on this point. I too grew up in an underprivileged circumstance, and I think I make this mistake, and you kind of call me out on it in the book. You say, and I'm quoting, sometimes people assume that if people are poor, they are too busy trying to survive to work on larger issues.
Right.
Now, tell me about your personal experience. You don't agree based on your personal experience.
I don't, because I worked in very poor communities, and I still continue to do training and work in poor communities. And what I've found is if people have hope, if they have vision, if it's accessible, you know, where they can bring their children or there's childcare, and they will come out in droves if they believe they can really make change and they can see that change happening. A lot of people talk about people being apathetic. I don't believe that either. I think people are hopeless or feel they can't make change and are powerless. So I feel like if people get a taste of changing things for their lives and for the future of their children and grandchildren, they'll be there. And I've seen it over and over.
So then what are the barriers to the goal? You do write about the barriers that are out there, the isms that we hear about.
Right. Well, I do think there's a lot of race and class issues, but I think we have to work on it from a place of love and not polarization. We have to work on it through telling our own stories, through building trust. I talk a lot about how to create a trusting environment, a place where we tell our own stories. And I call it going slow to go fast, because if we take that time, which organizers often don't want to do because we're in such a rush to fix things, if we take that time up front, then we can move much faster in winning huge accomplishments that we didn't believe possible.
And it's not just a feel-good book. I mean, this is really got a lot of concrete steps. In fact, you call it stepping into the circle.
Right.
Concrete steps that we need to take. And I know we can't read the whole book right here in a short segment, but identify a few of the steps, methods, you call them, that we can take, techniques, I guess you call them, to unite the team members, the collective, toward the goal.
Well, I think there is a piece of building that trust, and I talk a lot about how to do that, how to create an environment that everyone can feel welcomed in, no matter where they're from or where they were born or what class or race they come from, what religion they come from, and then how to really vision together and then create a roadmap. You know, as one of the kids in New Orleans, one of the stories I tell about this amazing work that young junior high school students have totally made powerful changes in their public schools in New Orleans. And one of the kids said when we first visioned, well, this is just pretend. And I said, you're right. It is pretend unless we're creating a plan and working together on how to make it happen. And they've made amazing things happen.
And in the little bit of time we have left, can you give us an example of collective visioning that you have seen? And I know you say we have to be patient. Nothing happens overnight, even though organizers and activists, hopeful as we are, want things to happen quickly. But have you had an example of collective visioning that you've seen work.
Over and over, and I tell about that in the book, a lot of stories. But I'll go back to the kids in New Orleans because I'm going to be up there and down there in a couple weeks. And they have made it so that every public school has to have public gardens, community gardens, restorative justice circles, and they just won a big campaign against a multinational corporation to provide local farm-grown food and healthy food alternatives.
Well, that is a lovely springtime example of collective visioning at its best. And Linda Stout is the executive director of Spirit in Action. Her new book is Collective Visioning, How Groups Can Work Together for a Just and Sustainable Future. Linda, thank you so much for joining us here in our studios.